Today's episode is brought to you by AOS Kitchens, the South's leading outdoor kitchen design and installation specialists. Welcome to another episode of the Meet and Greet Barbecue podcast. Today we are joined by Genevieve Taylor. Super excited to have Genevieve on. She's got a wealth of knowledge. She has her own cookery school, multiple barbecue and cookbooks, and sourcing ethical charcoal is super important to Genevieve and a topic of the podcast. So without further ado, here's Genevieve.
Hello, Genevieve. For anyone who might not know who you are, would you like to introduce yourself?
Well, I am a live fire cook and barbecue chef. I write cookery books about barbecuing, and I run the Bristol Fire School, which is like a cookery school dedicated to anything to do with fire, basically.
Amazing. So how did you originally get started in barbecue? Is it something that was kind of in your blood that you used to do with your parents when you were younger? How did you get into it all?
No, not at all. I can genuinely say I can't remember a single barbecue as a child. I think, did we even have one? No, I don't think we did. I got started because I like being outside. That's mm-hmm. kind of where I'm happiest. I've always cooked, like always, since being a child. My mum was a single parent, and me and my brother were expected to kind of help get the dinner on the table when she was working. I think the outside cooking is just from a love of being outside, really. I'm a biologist by training, so I used to work in wildlife television as a wow. producer, and I gave all that up when I had my kids, who are quite big now. And then that's really when I started getting outside to cook. It started like as an act of selfishness, I guess, because I was so bored of feeding the little buggers in the kitchen. Like, I don't know if you've got kids, you have to feed them, don't you?
Yeah.
And it's really bloody boring, like every day, like three times a day. So for me, it was just about being selfish, getting outside to make my life a bit more interesting, because I didn't want to be stuck in the kitchen. So that's kind of it, really. And it just spiraled from that, you know?
And when you were going through, when you started to kind of get outside and get cooking on the barbecue, were your kids, you know, did they really enjoy the kind of transfer from the oven to the barbecue?
I mean, they used to kind of get involved and help. They're kind of nearly 15 and nearly 18 now. But they used to kind of get stuck in. And it was fun. It was something we used to do as a sort of activity, you know, after school or whatever.
So how have you managed to go from, like you just said, wanting to do something different outside of cooking to being an author, to have, like you said, to having demonstrations, a cookery school? Where did you go from here to here?
Well, it's just been an absolute journey. You know, I like working hard. I always got a plan and a project, and there's always sort of irons in different fires, excuse the pun, but there's always stuff that I'm working on, you know, different things. Yeah. And I guess, you know, I've never really had a normal job, you know. Even when I was in telly, I was like a freelancer and I worked for myself, and you know, so I'm just sort of very used to kind of making my work up as I go along. That's just how it's always been for me. So I've just sort of, you know, tried to be brave about it and grasp opportunities and make opportunities. And, you know, apart from anything else, just work really bloody hard. You know, I kind of pretty much work constantly, and that's mostly the way I like it.
Something that I've been loving while following your account and learning from bits and pieces that you've been doing online is that there's no filler, there's no crap, and you also don't take any crap. In particular, I remember a post quite recently when, and I 100% agree, you were getting frustrated and saying, don't listen to people who tell you fallacies. For example, if you want to put on charcoal mid-cook, as long as you're good quality charcoal, does not matter. Don't let people put you off doing things and trying different things. I love that. I love all of that.
I don't know. I mean, 99% of people on Instagram are really amazing, and it's like a great space. And most people in the kind of barbecue world, or people who are just keen to learn, they're amazing. But just like any kind of field, you know, there's the odd arsehole who comes and sort of spoils it every now and then. And I'm not going to be kind of bullied by people who are telling me I'm doing it wrong, because there's
you're clearly doing it right.
I mean, you know, there's different ways to do things, aren't there?
Yeah.
And, you know, that's one of the things that I love about barbecue is it's just, you know, it's never going to be that kind of cooking where you can make it really prescriptive and go from A to B to C, and it's the same for everybody. It's a challenge because, you know, every fire I light is slightly different to the one I lit yesterday, be the same for you guys. You know, there's so many variables, you know, with the weather and the fuel, and, you know, and I think that's why one of the reasons I like it is it's always challenging. So for people to sort of come to you and say, you can't do it like that, doesn't work. It's like, well, it does, you know, it can do. It's just, you know, but it's just different from the way you do it. But yeah. But yeah, that fuel thing really kind of got my goat. So yeah, I had to have a little rant about that.
I think it's important too, because if there's anyone out there who either has like a new account or they're kind of getting into something, they're scared of doing something wrong, all it takes is one asshole to comment and completely deflate them, and they're missing out on something that's amazing. It's great for well-being, it's fun to do, and it's kind of a gift for other people, barbecue as well. That's why I love it. And if someone's going to say something wrong and nasty to them, it's great that people can see people like you calling them out and saying, no, it's about having a good time, you can do these things.
Yeah, I mean, I'm always going to call people out who are unpleasant, because I just sort of feel like I've got a moral obligation to do that. I'm not going to let anybody bully me. And then, you know, if nobody ever calls out the bullies, they just keep on doing it, don't they? They find somebody else to bully. But most people are really nice. So it's not, you know, my thing with Instagram is 99% positive. Mm. But, you know, you get people who just can't resist saying something unkind, can you? And you just think, I don't know, I've been saying it to my kids since they were tiny. If you can't be kind, just say nothing. Like, just go away and say nothing. You know, nobody's interested in your meanness.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. I mean, so I look after the social channels for this podcast. Mm. And I haven't even mentioned Dan, actually. I put just a tiny little reel, just a couple of seconds. And all it was just lifting up a barbecue, just showing that I've cook some burgers and sausages, something simple for a midweek. And someone actually went, you're a cheat. They were cooked indoors. I was like, you've just seen me lift the lid up. Why would I bother firing up a barbecue just for that purpose?
And some people just can't get it, can they? I mean, and that's fine. There's always going to be people who are happier cooking in the kitchen.
Yeah.
And there's always going to be people who want a slightly more adventurous way of living. And that's fine, but, you know, we don't need to criticize each other. It's just you do your thing and I'll do my thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Talking about obviously what Dan was saying about, you know, some of the videos and things you've put on recently. So you've I suppose literally within the last week done a bit of an education series on Instagram.
Yeah, I have my kind of brisket fandango. Yeah, so I went to Texas for a couple of weeks and really lucky I kind of went and worked at different kind of amazing kind of barbecue restaurants. I did a couple of days here and a couple of days there, spent 2 weeks driving myself around Texas, and I learned so much. And you know, I wanted to kind of, as much for myself as anything, but just kind of crystallize all of that information into like, right, this is how I'm gonna do it. And I think I really struggle with reels because they're only 60 seconds. And I think, what can you explain properly in 60 seconds? You know, it's I find them quite gimmicky. So I was just like, right, I'm just going to do a whole thing. I'm going to break the whole cook of a brisket down into this, 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 and this, this. And it was really detailed. And it kind of, I just felt like I wanted to make it detailed, really.
I think it worked quite well, though, because, you know, everyone knows the reason they're only 60 seconds is because people's attention spans are not that great anymore. Therefore, so it's quite good that it was broken down into almost bite-sized pieces that people could probably, you know, they could follow along as they were doing it rather than having to necessarily watch something on YouTube that might take 35 minutes, you know?
Exactly. I mean, and it was, you know, it was absolutely a marathon. I mean, cooking a whole brisket is hard enough as it is without having to sort of do the filming and the editing and the sound. And like, I don't know, I think some people think that there's like, I've got a whole gang of people, but it's literally me and an iPhone in my garden and, you know, trying to work it out and do it in between the postman coming and the dog barking and like, you know, it's so it sometimes it's a bit shambolic, but I mean what anybody is always gonna get with me is just kind of how it is, you know, there's no gilding the lily. It's this is what I, you know, it's real.
It is real. And I loved the regret that I could see in your eyes when you started to use the jogging metaphor for the stall.
Yeah, I was like,
you're like, I'm gonna have to keep doing this for a little
while. I hate running. But thankfully it was only 60 seconds and I didn't need to kind of run, you know, for hours. So
is brisket something that you cook quite often, or is that kind of a special?
No, not really. I mean, to be honest, I cook a lot of things. It sort of depends what's going on. A whole brisket will feed so many people. It isn't, and for me, it's like a real treat. It's an absolute labour of love. I mean, the whole process took about 3 days from start to finish. You know, with the dry brining and then the smoking and then the resting and, you know. So it is certainly isn't something, and a whole brisket costs a lot of money. It was like 90 quid's worth of meat, and it's like I'm not going to do that very often, which is partly why I wanted to really nail it with those reels. So it's like, you know, that I'm not going to do it again for a while.
What I really enjoyed, because I did a brisket on the weekend as well, but a much, much smaller cut of brisket. So it was two kilos.
Yeah.
And I've done brisket a few times before around that sort of size. I had 10 people coming over and I also did some pulled pork.
Nice.
But I hit the stall in a way that I never have done with that size of meat before, which I was lucky I had other things I'd learned from prior mistakes so I could feed people while they were waiting. But this cut, 2 kilograms in the past has taken between kind of 6 and 8 hours, right? Yeah,
sure.
Took 11 and a half hours. It hit and it wasn't going anywhere. And it got like 3 hours later and there's people there. And I'm like, how can I tell people that it's only just hit 80 degrees? I need to wait. I want at least another 15 and then I need to rest. But I had never considered resting it as long as you had. Obviously, it's a much bigger piece of meat that you're talking about.
You know, but I think that's the really important bit that I learned in Texas was just how long they rest it for. Because, I mean, I've cooked lots of briskets and then I got to Texas and I thought, actually, my brisket is pretty average compared to the brisket I was eating. And I spent 2 weeks trying to work out what I was doing differently. Pretty much it's that long rest, like literally it just makes such a big difference, I think.
So for anyone who hasn't seen it, how long really should you be resting that brisket to get those sorts of results?
I mean, in the States, they rest overnight. So they put their brisket on at like 7 o'clock in the morning, pretty much. And they cook it through until it's done. You know as well as I do that barbecue is done when it's done. You can't kind of put a number on it. So that might, they may have pulled it off the smoker at sort of 9, 10, 11, midnight, something like that. So, all day. And then they'll rest it until the service the next day, which tends to start about 11 in the morning. So, I mean, they're going in for like a full 12-hour rest, which is kind of what I did with mine here, partly because I wanted to just see what happened because I'd never done that before. So for me, it was just trying to, like I said, distill everything I learned to see, right, if I do all these things, what's going to happen? And it was brilliant. I mean, I don't know if you would need to rest it as long as that. I mean, I guess for them, partly it's a service thing. It's like they... that this fits in with how they cook it. I mean, that's the difficult thing, isn't it? It's like, how do you schedule that so that it's ready for when people want to eat it? But I reckon a minimum of 4 hours. I don't think I'd rest it any less than that. And if I could do it for kind of 6 or 8, I think I would do that for sure, because it just make it just compared to the briskets I'd done prior to resting it that long, it was like a world of difference.
I normally get 2 hours, two and a bit hours, and then I get so blooming impatient.
Exactly.
That you've spent 10 hours, 11 hours cooking. I just want to eat it now.
So if I can eat this stuff now. Yeah. because in my head, I was going for that long rest and we weren't going to eat it. It was like, you know, it was okay. But yeah, no, I get that. Especially if you've got kind of hungry family going, oh, you want to eat it? It smells good or whatever.
What was quite interesting when you started the first video, you were kind of talking about grass-fed British brisket in comparison to the US, which is generally corn-fed, isn't it?
It's generally corn-fed, and they produce meat on such a different scale to we do here. I mean, it's like... it's phenomenal, the process, you know, the kind of meat lots and so on. I don't think it's ideal. That I don't, you know, it's just sort of gross. I don't know, I don't want to sound like really negative about it, but it's almost like these cows are being force-fed grain to get them fatter and fatter and fatter and fatter. And it's a very unnatural way for cows to eat. And yeah, you get really kind of rich, fatty meat. But the kind of detriment to the environment, I think, is massive. You know, these, you know, vast swathes of grain and soya, you know, that causes huge amounts of deforestation to produce this grain and so on. And it's a really, you know, it's really environmentally very negative. And that's important to me, to source my meat carefully and thoughtfully. I would rather eat kind of meat once a week and make sure I'd bought something that was really special than sort of eat meat every night and it was kind of crap, basically. And that's my choice, you know, as I say all the time, that everybody draws their own personal line in the sand, don't they? And that's one of my lines, is that I won't buy, obviously in America I ate American beef, but I wouldn't dream of buying American beef in Britain. Wouldn't even occur to me. You know, I don't think it's better than our beef. I think in a lot of ways we do beef better. We have better grass. And we're much more thoughtful about kind of the kind of environmental consequences of sort of mass farming these days. And it's just one of those things that's really important to me. And so I just wanted to kind of get that out there. I mean, I got a bit of stick for that, but you know. You
do. Oh, really?
Well, a few people said, like, you know, I had people saying that USDA Prime was the only way to go, and you know, I you know, just sort of ranting on, really.
I've never tried it, but for me, I'd like to source my meat from my local butcher, knowing that it's come, you know, within, hasn't done a lot of food miles.
Exactly.
That's my preference.
Exactly. And no, I totally agree. And I'm the same about fuel. You know, I won't burn fuel that's not British. I just won't do it. And that's another one of my my lines in the sand that I've drawn. Yeah.
So I'd like to kind of move on from the kind of social side of what you've been doing recently, and talk about some of your books.
Yeah.
So you've released one just recently, haven't you?
Yeah, I had one come out in the end of April, Seared. So it's like a meat Bible.
Fantastic. Yeah. So I suppose this is a question that's relevant for all of the books that you've done. Yeah, obviously, sure. You've got a few out now.
Yeah.
Where do you get that inspiration?
I've done a lot of travelling in my life. One of the things that I did when I worked in television, you know, travelled all over the world, ate a lot of amazing food. You know, if you think about fire, really is, you know, it's where cooking began with fire. So it's like the beginning of it all. And there's not a country on this planet that doesn't have a history of cooking with fire. So if you look deep enough, you'll find kind of fire-based recipes and, you know, very sort of, you know, going back for millennia. But also for me, the fire is literally the heat source. It's like a gas hob, or it's like an electric oven. You know, I'm just using the fire to cook. So I don't differentiate food that I cook as being barbecue food and not barbecue food, it's just food, and I happen to cook it over fire. So for me, the inspiration comes from just all the places I've been in the world, all the things I've eaten, all the things I like to eat. I'm quite greedy, so I kind of dream in recipes. A lot of my recipes, they come to me in the night and I think, yeah, that might work. So it's just a sort of fairly organic process, really, sort of drawing on inspiration and, you know, what I've got in the fridge. Just, it's just something I really enjoy doing. You know, that's the almost the best bit of writing a book is coming up with all the ideas.
And do you have to then almost, I suppose, test those recipes, give them a good run out a few times before actually whether decide that makes the book?
Exactly. Yeah, 100%. Yeah. So sometimes it happens, I don't know, I mean, I don't have a fixed way that I write books, but yeah, all the recipes are tested, but sometimes I do a bit here and a bit there, and sometimes I, you know, write out a few recipes and then I have a big kind of testing day. You know, it just sort of depends what else is going on, really.
One of the books that I wanted to talk about and I've just recently purchased is your vegetarian book. As an absolute meat eater, I love meat. Don't get me wrong, I do love vegetables, but I struggle for inspiration. Yeah. And where my wife is, you know, she's so into, you know, she loves all the barbecue food that we do, but she is kind of starting to get fed up of it just being meat overload. So, again, it's, I suppose, for something that is, barbecue is generally traditionally a very meat-heavy sport. what would you, again, there's some fantastic recipes in there. How did you, was it the purpose of that book to actually try and give some meat lovers some real inspiration where they just, you know, it's all about slapping a brisket on, but actually think about the stuff that goes with it?
You've absolutely hit the nail on the head there. I didn't write it. I mean, it's a vegetarian barbecue book, but I didn't write it for vegetarians. I wrote it for kind of big ass hairy barbecue blokes that they can only cook meat on the barbecue. So that's who I wrote it for. In my mind, it was like, come on guys, you know, this is the kind of breadth of stuff you can cook on a barbecue. And in some ways I think barbecues, in inverted commas, they're like the last bastion of the carnival, aren't they? In some ways, there's no, if you think about all the meals you might want to share with your friends and your family, like celebratory sort of meal, party meals, whatever, there's none where you might be expected to sit down and eat a rib, a piece of chicken, a sausage, a kebab, a bit of steak, maybe a chicken leg, all in one sitting. I mean, it's just like boom, boom, boom. And personally, I don't want to eat like that. You know, even that kind of English thing of the Sunday roast, you have one really beautifully thought out joint of meat and then a lot of side dishes that you've also thought about, you know, that and that for me makes a meal. You know, I don't want to go to somebody's house and eat six different kinds of meat and a little bit of coleslaw. You know, I want a kind of slightly more balanced experience than that. So I guess that was my starting point for it, was that to just sort of expand the repertoire of people who think that you have to kind of make it a kind of mixed grill. Also,
the one that the first one I'm going to try is the whole smoked celeriac. That looked quite good.
So easy. Easy. I mean, it's like, it's three ingredients. It's celeriac, coriander seeds and olive oil and a bit of salt. Salt doesn't count in my mind because everything has salt. But you know, it's dead simple.
I suppose it's quite a meaty vegetable in a sense, isn't it?
Yeah, it's just got quite complex, interesting flavours, I think. And by the time you've smoked it for sort of hours, I mean, that's the thing about vegetables, is they often take a lot longer than you might imagine. You know, if you're smoking a whole cauliflower, for example, it's like 3 hours probably to do it justice.
So over the weekend, I find that if I'm doing a cook, if possible, I want to have my grill as full as possible, so I'm getting the most out of the energy that I'm using. Which again, I did the brisket, I did pulled pork, then I also had some vegetarians coming over. So I actually did a moussaka and I smoked that as well, which it's amazing. And it's now like the veggie moussaka is probably my favorite vegetarian meal I've done on there.
Yeah.
What's your favourite vegetarian meal to do on the barbecue?
I don't know. I mean, I do quite a lot of different things, like you might imagine. I mean, one of the things I've done recently is like a whole kind of satay cauliflower. That's really nice. So with, you know, make a kind of butter with spices and soy sauce, and then that goes on the cauliflower, and then make a satay sauce. So it's like building kind of layers of flavour. So it isn't just a cauliflower, you know. Mm. There's lots of interesting stuff going on, and I think that's what makes vegetables interesting on the grill. Because if you think about like meat, I love meat, but it's can be quite one-dimensional in terms of texture, yeah. And to a certain extent taste. You know, there's not wildly different tastes between different meats sometimes, certainly between beef and lamb or whatever. But vegetables, the whole kind of spectrum of it, the kind of colour and the texture and the flavour and the, you know, I think they can be more exciting if you kind of layer dishes up. And that, I think that's probably why chefs like Ottolenghi are so amazingly well thought of, because, you know, his dishes, it's not just a vegetable on a plate. It's like a really well thought out layering of different ingredients to get a kind of a dish that's more than the sum of its parts, I suppose.
And I think it comes back to confidence for people like myself. Mm. You know, I've been cooking meat on a grill for years. It's, yeah. But it's just, I've never invested the time into vegetables. They've always been that afterthought. So yeah. I've never really had the confidence to cut, you know, almost make the vegetable the star.
Yeah, you know.
It's always hiding behind a piece of beef or whatever.
Yeah. But hopefully you might find some stuff to try.
My wife is super excited about it. So she's been crying out for more vegetables.
I'd love to know about your setup. And if you have a number of different grills, like, do you have a favourite that you lean on kind of day in, day out, and then others you do for special occasions? Ooh.
Yeah.
What's your setup? I mean,
I've got, because I run the cookery school here, as you can imagine, I've got lots of different barbecues. If I could only have one, I would have a really classic kind of Weber kettle. I think they're brilliant. Most of my recipes in my books, I write on those, if not, you know, the vast majority, because I think it's really accessible for people. There's no point me writing recipes for a Kamado Joe if 99% of the country haven't got one. You know, that would just be silly. Yeah. And also kind of to prove that actually you can pretty much cook anything or anything. You don't necessarily need a 2 grand piece of massive barbecue. You know, you can do it. And that's, yeah, so I've got lots of different bits of kit here. I'm a big fan of a lid. To my mind, a lid is kind of really important. And even if I'm doing, I've got a lovely kind of ox grill, kind of Argentinian paella, you know, I want to kind of get that lid effect by trapping in the kind of hot air. So I would tend to kind of put cloche on stuff if I'm using that, or, you know, even invent a cloche with like a metal bowl or a bit of foil, or, you know, I think covering stuff up is good. The brisket that I just did last week, I cooked on my oil drum barbecue, and I had to cook it on there. It was the only thing it would fit on, basically. And I was really nervous about it because I've never cooked a brisket on an oil drum barbecue, and I was like, maybe this is not going to work. So I lined it with fire bricks to kind of.
Okay.
Give it some more insulation, because that's when I use that, it kind of really munches fuel, and that made the biggest of difference. You know, that whole brisket cook probably took me 12 hours, I reckon, maybe 13 hours. I don't know, I probably used about 12 logs, you know, and that was it in the whole time, and it just ran like a dream. You know, it was really steady in the temperature. It was great. So, yeah, I mean, I have lots of different kit.
The Weber is a classic, isn't it? I've had my Weber kettle for just shy of 10 years.
Yeah. No, I love it. It's great. And they're so versatile.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's lots of accessories you can buy now for them as well, isn't there, to kind of pimp them out with all sorts of bits and pieces.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a massive fan of loads of gadgets and stuff, but I do love the rotisserie. Love that. And I love that, you know, mine's got charcoal baskets in, so you can pick the fire up with tongs and sort of move it places, and that's really helpful. So halfway through cooking, you might feel you want a slightly different heat, so you can just sort of grab it and move it. That's really handy. Sorry, I've got a really bad tickle. I've got a bit of a cold at the moment.
It's going around. I know quite a few people.
It's like, yeah.
So you mentioned the school, your cookery school.
Yeah.
So that's actually in your back garden, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Yeah, I'd wave my computer around, but my back garden is an absolute mess at the moment. We had a big party at the weekend and there's still kind of beer bottles all over the place. It's a bit general.
So, how long have you been running the school?
I had one class before the first kind of lockdown. So this is my third summer. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I started it because I had a garden full of barbecues, you know, and at that point I was struggling to get my next book commissioned. That, like, it's, you know, I've written 12 books now and I've just started number 13, but each one is quite hard to get commissioned. It's not an easy ride at all, so you have to work quite hard to prove it's going to be a kind of seller. So there was a point where, and it was in the middle of the winter, I hate winter, and I couldn't get a book commissioned, and I was like, oh my god, I'm gonna go mad if I don't have a thing to focus on, you know. I needed a thing. It goes back to the whole thing of needing to be busy. And I thought, well, I'll just, you know, I've got all these barbecues, I can get people to come around and I'll show them how to kind of cook. And, you know, I spent a month or so plotting and planning and then put some tickets on sale and they went in minutes, you know. And then I put some more on and they went in minutes, and it's just sort of spiraled from that, really. And and now I can't, you know, I can't keep up with the demand for them because there isn't enough hours in the day, as you all know, and you're trying to so I put on as many as I can without killing myself, and I really enjoy it. You know, it's brilliant. I have kind of 8 people at once, and
so quite intimate groups then.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no, it really is. And you know, we just sort of cook and eat together, and I really like that.
If you've been looking or thinking about an outdoor kitchen, then look no further than AOS Outdoor Kitchens.
They are the South's leading outdoor kitchen design and installation specialists.
Their extensive showroom is based just outside Bournemouth on the Dorset-Hampshire border, and as well as numerous in-store displays, also features a live outdoor kitchen where they cook every week on Kamado grills, pizza ovens, and all filmed and shown on YouTube.
They offer a wealth of knowledge on how to transform your patio into the most incredible outdoor dining area, with styles and options to suit every budget. And you can guarantee they will be able to create something perfectly suited to you and your home.
They stock and supply everything that you're going to need for outdoor cooking, including barbecues, Kamado ovens, pizza ovens, outdoor fridges, and every accessory that you would need to become the ultimate outdoor chef.
So if you want to make yourself the envy of your friends and neighbours, get in touch with them today to arrange a consultation and take the first step in transforming your back garden into the most incredible entertainment space.
Visit aoskitchens.co.uk. So you do a few different types of courses, don't you?
Yeah, I do. I sort of do a fundamentals one and an intermediate one, and I do wood-fired ovens because they're quite specific pieces of kit, you know, different from barbecues, the way they work. And I do like a Kamado class, you know, sort of covering the ceramic type Kamado J Big Green Egg sort of ovens. And then I'm, you know, I do the odd sort of specialist ones. So I've have done vegetarian ones, have done sort of fish ones. Yeah.
Are you planning to kind of expand the operation, or are you kind of at the limit of where you are at the minute?
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm not interested. People have said, am I going to sort of franchise it or whatever? And I'm just not interested because, you know, what you get is me cooking in my garden, and, you know, I'm not, I wouldn't want anybody else to do it on my behalf. It's like, this is it. So I need to fit it in around, you know, writing books and festivals and all the other stuff I'm doing. And that's nice, you know, that suits me to not, I don't want it to be out of control and big. It's just here.
as part of those classes, you must get a lot of questions thrown at you. But do you find that the same ones come up often that people are unsure about or a bit nervous even to ask?
Yeah, I mean, questions are brilliant. You know, I thrive on questions because it makes you a better teacher when you're kind of learning what people need to know. We talk a lot about fuel because it's something that I'm super passionate about. You know, what is good fuel? And I really believe it's your sort of number one ingredient when you're barbecuing. So we talk a lot about fuel. We talk a lot of geeky stuff about kind of science, you know, the science of fire and physics and so on. And once you understand a little bit of that basic science, then you can work out where to put your food in relation to the fire because you kind of know what's going on in there. So we do quite a lot of geeky stuff. I mean, you know, that really floats my boat, all that. But yeah, apart from that, it's just... you know, it's just, I kind of know, we always have a menu that we're cooking to on each day, but I never have a fixed plan about which bit of kit I'm going to fire up. You know, I just wait and see on the day what people are like, because I've never met them before. You know, we sort of begin the day by finding out what people have got at home that they cook on and what they, you know, if they want to learn something specific or there's something they find hard, you know, I always start the day like that. And then we just make it up as we're going along, really.
Do you find that you get more beginners coming to your school or?
Yeah, all sorts. Yeah, all sorts of people. Yeah.
Good. So I'd like to understand, so we love barbecue fails and some of the things that haven't gone so well. So we'd be quite interested to know if you could share with us any fails, recent or otherwise.
Recent fails. Most of my things that have gone wrong are because you get distracted. I think that's the thing with fire cooking, is that you really have to kind of be with it and in the moment, and things go wrong when you're trying to do too much at once, you know, and you've got the kids inside and you've got to help them with their homework and you need to hang some washing out and you need to do this and you need to do that and you're trying to do Zoom meetings and, you know, answer emails at the same time. That for me is when things go wrong, is when I've just got too many plates in there, because you want to be with it and be absorbed. I don't know. I mean, I had a class probably last summer, I think, and we did some Yorkshire puddings and we completely forgot about them and they were like little black spheres. I put them up on Instagram, but I thought they were so funny. Completely black. So that was quite funny. But it's just when you lose your kind of train of thought, you know.
Yeah.
But most things are, you can come back from with a bit of thinking. Not the Yorkshire puddings. They were terminal. They were. They absolutely went in the bin. I'd made charcoal, basically. I'd made Yorkshire pudding charcoal.
Could have fired them back up for tomorrow's cook.
Yeah, exactly. That, yeah.
Oh, good.
Well, thing is, like, you learn from that, don't you? I mean, my two mistakes on the weekend, I've already mentioned one of them, is the timing thing. You can't assume a meat's going to take a certain amount of time, and no matter how much we talk about it, it's very easy to fall into that mistake. So
yeah.
I got up at 4, started everything on at 5. I had the pulled pork that was just under 2 kilos and this brisket, and I thought, right, prior experience, 6 to 8 hours, bring it off about 12 or 1 and I'll be able to let it rest for 2-3 hours as people come over at 1, we'll start eating at 2 and we'll slowly have things come out.
Yeah.
And when you get to hour like 10,
yeah,
and there's people there that are eating, they're like, you still got the barbecue on. I was like, I know. I can't do anything about this. It's doing what it's doing. But you know, it all worked out in the end, and we eventually managed to eat that brisket about 6:15, I think it was.
Yeah.
And people enjoyed it, which is great. And I've got leftovers to last me, because that's the other thing that I'm passionate about, is making sure if you're cooking, you've got loads of other stuff you can do with it. But the other thing I did, which is stupid, pulled pork, cooked it, rested it, great.
Yeah.
Waited 2 hours, put my gloves on to pull it, and burnt the crap out of my hands. Yeah. I just thought, right, I'm going to do this straight in, bang, and then it's too late because you're already like, wrist deep in molten pork. So,
yeah.
But, you know, we learn from these things and that's how we improve, I hope.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. I mean, I'm always burning myself. I'm kind of covered in burns. Yeah, I don't cut myself that often, touch wood, but yeah, burn myself all the time.
I do as well. And I seem to do it when I've got, you know, when you get the old chimney starter, you put it down next to the barbecue, forget it's there, and then step back, burn your legs on it. Or
touch it. Yeah.
I had a fail last week. I was cooking, I've recently bought a, for the Weber kettle, a half plancha, kind of half grill. So I thought I'd cook a breakfast. And normally when I've done eggs, I've used the pan in on the barbecue. But this time I thought I'd go straight onto the plancha. And I put a load of eggs on. They stuck badly. But I actually ended up losing one. As I opened it, it kind of slipped and went straight through the middle. Even missed the charcoal underneath where I was two-zoning. It went straight into the ash bin at the bottom.
Nice.
So I ended up using, I got about three. It took me about six eggs to get three. They were just awful. It was almost scrambled like.
Maybe it just needed seasoning. They sometimes new pans, they don't, they need a bit of time to bed in, don't they? I think new kind of surfaces.
They do. And I just don't think I perhaps seasoned it well enough.
Maybe anyway. So it's like when you're doing pancakes, isn't it? Inside, you're never quite patient enough to let it get hot enough, so the first one is always shit because you know it's not hot enough when you're sort of ladling it on there, but you just say, I'm just gonna just see if it's hot enough, and you know it isn't gonna be. I think it's that's all the same.
That's it. I think it's a problem when you cook hungry, isn't it? It's you cook hungry and then you're impatient.
Yeah, I think that's one of my top tips about when you've got people coming over, you just gotta have loads of snacks because it's always gonna take longer than you want it to.
Yeah,
lots of snacks.
You talked about as well, like not being that excited about the different like tech and things. And I like the fact that you're talking about barbecue in its purest form. If someone hasn't really barbecued much, or even if they're thinking about getting a new setup, what essentials do you think people should look for? And also stuff, what stuff do people get flogged that is not needed at all and is a waste?
I think a good quality meat probe I would consider to be an essential bit of kit, especially if you're quite new to barbecuing, because it just absolutely gives you confidence that your food is done. So I wouldn't dream about cooking a piece of meat without wanging a probe in it, just so I know. And I think one of the mistakes people can make is we're so paranoid about undercooking kind of chicken or whatever that we just like cremate the bejesus out of it just to be safe. So I think often we overcook stuff, really. So meat probe for sure. I'm a big fan of my little chimney starter that I always light my Weber up with. The best charcoal you can get hold of is way more important to me than any kind of gadgets and stuff. I'm not a massive fan of sort of different grill surfaces, you know, kind of cast iron ones. And I just think essentially if you've lit a good fire, they're all going to do pretty much the same job, actually. And I think people are sort of flogged the idea of cast iron grill surfaces so they can get perfect grill bar marks on their steak, which is sort of totally the wrong approach to cooking a steak, as far as I'm concerned. I don't know if you want to go into that.
No, let's go into that. That's what we want to do. Because at home, who cares about 10 to 2? Do you know what I mean? You just want a nice steak.
I don't even know what 10 to 2 is. Is that where you put it one way and then turn it the other way so you get your crossbars? Right. So grill bar marks are absolute load of old bollocks, basically. If you imagine, you guys will know about the Maillard reaction, you know, that browning reaction. Which is why brown food tastes better than not brown food, which is like why a perfectly browned seared steak tastes infinitely nicer than if you boiled it in a pan of water. You know, you're adding kind of really complex flavors with this chemical reaction called Maillard. So if the evidence that this Maillard chemical chain reaction has occurred is seen in the brown markings, if you've got perfect grill bar marks on your steak, what's happening here?
Not the
Maillard reaction, essentially. Yeah. So you're really missing out on a whole world of kind of flavour potential because somebody somewhere told you that steak should be stripy. It shouldn't be stripy. What the aim is to get that steak as browned all over as evenly as possible. And for that reason, there's, you know, I've got some reasonably controversial thoughts about how to cook steak, including cooking them from fridge cold. Because what you're doing with very fridge cold meat is you're giving yourself time.
I've been reading about this. Yeah, you get a better crust. Yeah,
get a better crust. Because if you've got a warm steak, like room temperature 20 Celsius or whatever, you've only got like a sort of 20, 30 degree margin to get that crust because you don't want to overcook it. You know, if you want to eat your steak rare, you haven't got much time. But if you're starting with a steak that's come straight out of the fridge and is like 3, 4, 5 degrees Celsius, you've got another 20 degrees to play with here to get that steak done how you want it to be done on the outside without overcooking the mizzle.
So how do you like your steak?
Rare, unless it's rare. A ribeye, and I think ribeyes you need to take them a tiny bit more than rare, so sort of medium rare to kind of render that sort of lovely little nugget of fat. You want to get some heat into that. But my favourite cut of steak is kind of hanger steak omelette, which you definitely want to eat it good and rare.
We love some hanger. Me and Dan came over at Christmas and we cooked it dirty straight on the coals. It was lovely, nice and crisp on the outside.
So dirty straight on the coals. That's another of my bugbears with steak.
I was going to ask you how you prefer to cook it. That was my next question.
Because I don't think it's the best way to cook a steak. Because if you've got a lit amount of charcoal and you need that oxygen flowing to keep your fire hot, so what happens if you slap a whacking great cold steak on a fire? Essentially, you put the fire out underneath the steak. So cooking a steak dirty is quite a gentle way to cook a steak. And I don't think gentle is what you want with most steak cooking. So you know, people do it, but I don't personally think it's the best way to cook steak.
It's only the second time I've done it.
Yeah.
And
amazing. You know, but sometimes things are a bit style over substance, I think, aren't they?
Yeah.
Particularly after we've had a few beers at Christmas.
Yeah, exactly.
So what are you sort of just straight on a grill, hot and fast? Do you like to reverse sear? How do you prefer to cook?
Depends on the cut. So I'm a really big fan of reverse sear. I think it's fantastic because you get that very even temperature all the way through, which is really good. So essentially you know that each mouthful of steak is going to be cooked perfectly. But you have to start with a thick one. You know, it's got to be at least, you know, 4 or 5 centimeters thick to get a good reverse sear, I think. So for hanger steak omelette, that's too thin for reverse sear, so that just as hot as possible. And actually I mentioned that I'm a big fan of having a lid shut for, like, most barbecuing. Steak is the one time you definitely don't want to have a lid down. You want a very, very one directional heat from the bottom, hot. As soon as you bring a lid into that equation, you're going to make the whole thing, the heat, much more efficient. So again, it all roads lead back to Maillard reactions. You know, if you put a lid on, you're just going to overcook it before you have that really fierce heat. So lid up all the time for steak, so you can just like keep turning it over the really high heat.
Great. I think that's a good bit of advice for people, because steaks can be quite a controversial thing, kind of, because, you know, people want it certain ways, certain cuts.
I think they do. And I think, I don't know, I don't want to sound like a sort of reverse sexist, but I think there's a bit of sort of macho nonsense about steak that maybe doesn't help. You know, it gets in the way of cooking it properly. So people think like a massive tomahawk, you know, looks like kind of man yeah. stuff, but actually cooking a steak on the bone, I don't think is the best way to cook a steak either, because essentially what you're doing then is the bone is getting in the way of maximum contact with that grill surface. And all roads lead back to my odd reaction when you're talking about steak. You know, you want to get maximum contact, and you're paying for a massive bone that you're not going to eat. And in the kind of in the time that you're cooking that steak, absolutely none of that flavour from the bone will go in. If you were braising it in a liquid, you know, then you would get some flavour from the bone, but just sort of whacking it over a high heat, you're not going to get any benefit from that bone other than it looking kind of nice on Instagram, so you can hold it up and go like that.
Plus, when you're eating it, you're cutting it off the bone anyway.
Yes. Essentially, you're paying your butcher for a bone you're not going to eat.
You know, steak is actually, apart from lamb, because I don't like lamb, it's probably the least cut of meat that I eat.
Yeah.
I reckon probably 3 or 4 times a year I eat steak. Even though I love it, I just have to be in the mood for it. And actually, I'm not in the mood for it that often. I think I'd probably rather have chicken or something like that more often.
I mean, I think for me, steak should be like a real treat. And like you, I only really want to eat it 2, 3, 4 times a year. I don't want to eat it every weekend. I want to sort of buy really good steak and have it as a proper treat. And I guess if I was being really truthful, the cuts that I enjoy more are the really slow cooking cuts. That's what I love, is like, you know, like a piece of beef shin, you know, amazing on the barbecue if you smoke it for hours and hours and hours. And that's kind of what I'd rather eat probably than a steak a lot of the time. Yeah.
In your classes, do you go through with people what else they can do with the meat if they've got like leftovers and how to make it last and different ideas?
I mean, sort of a little bit. I definitely do in Seared, the book, because actually it's easier to cook. It's often a lot easier to cook a bigger joint of meat. You've got more control. You know, so I would always choose to cook like a 3-kilo joint of pork and then have the leftovers in the freezer or whatever, than try and cook a 1.5-kilo joint of pork. Because by the time you put in all that effort, you may as well have twice the amount of meat, and it freezes brilliantly, you know, smoked meat if you wrap it well. So we don't cover a lot of leftovers. So we just tend to eat what we've made, because there's, you know, 8 of us, 10 of us, whatever, with me and my assistant. But leftovers good.
Great. So talking about making some dishes and leftovers, I'd like to bring up my barbecue bingo wheel and see what you could cook us, if you're all right with that.
Yeah. Go for it.
Okay. So there's no like time limit or anything on it. And we've had some really interesting things. So once it's loaded up, you'll see there'll be some stuff that are actual dishes, some stuff that are more like actual ingredients. Okay. Like we had marmalade as one, for example, for someone in the past.
Yeah.
But one of the items on there is something that we call my signature dish, which is kind of something that you're known for. For yourself, what would you say is your signature dish?
I don't know. I don't know what my signature dish is. Maybe something vegetable-y.
Yeah.
I don't know if I've got a signature dish.
Well, what's your favourite thing then to cook? That's like asking you to pick from like 1,000 babies though, right?
I was thinking, what is my favourite thing to cook? I mean, I guess, you know, some sort of really sort of tough old slow cooking joint is probably my favourite thing to cook.
Let's say that then. Okay. Something very low and slow, if that comes up.
Yeah.
First and foremost, are you allergic to any of these?
Nope.
Good. We have had that in the past where we've had to take it off last minute. So just,
How long does this thing spin around for?
I haven't pressed it yet. I was just about to say, before I spin it, is there anything that's kind of picture fancy that you wouldn't mind giving a go?
No, I'm happy with any of those things.
Okay, I'll give it a spin.
It's my son coming.
I love the fact it's like beef shins on there, as if that was pre-organised.
Yeah. Do you want to put the oven? Oh, paella. I like paella. That's good.
It's not something I've ever done on the barbecue, stupidly. I make it quite a lot at home.
Yeah.
But thing is, my wife hates all sorts of seafood. I don't know why, it upsets me. But it means that when I'm doing it in the house, like chicken, chorizo, I was like, oh, I want some prawns in there. I want some like mussels and stuff. And
yeah, and she doesn't go for that. Yeah.
No. I should just do it.
In Spain, where paella comes from, sort of down in Valencia, they would have like hundreds of different variations. So the paella that we sort of think of that you might have eaten in Spain is just kind of one type. So they do lots of different styles of it. One of the ones that I really like is they do it with squid ink and squid. That's really nice. Yeah. I mean, your wife would hate it, but
I bet that would look exciting though, like the colours you get from it.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm quite keen for that. And actually, paella would very traditionally always be cooked over a wood fire. That's how they would always do it. Often with kind of grapevine trimmings and stuff. So it's a pretty good one for barbecuing.
Great. Well, we look forward to seeing what you come up with. If you wouldn't mind just tagging us in when you get the opportunity to cook it on Instagram, that'd be perfect.
Cool.
We always ask people who come on, there's a lot of stuff that you see on Instagram and people talk quite a lot about barbecue, and we always say, is there anything that you feel isn't being talked enough about in the community that actually would improve what people are doing and achieving?
I'm just gonna bang on about fuel again.
Go for it. We've done an episode or two in the past about fuel.
It's just so important to me that people know how bad charcoal is. And I think it's just critical. I mean, I would personally prefer people gave up barbecuing altogether and cooked on their induction hobs than buy charcoal that's been sourced really badly and has come from the rainforest of the Congo. Or, you know, I was in the co-op the other week with my kids and we saw disposable barbecues, and I turned it over and it's and the co-op's supposed to be quite a sort of ethical supermarket.
They are
local. This charcoal very clearly said that it was from made in Namibia, one of the most deforested countries on the planet. You know, most of Namibia is desert. What are we doing buying charcoal from Namibia? It's a real kind of passion of mine to to shout about that and how important it is, and I think not enough people think about it yet. Excuse me. And yes, good sustainable British lumpwood charcoal is more expensive than the shit stuff you pick up in Tesco's, but with a little bit of knowledge, which is hopefully where people like me come in, you can make it last twice as long because you don't waste it. You know, you become a really thoughtful barbecue because you think, you know, that's cost me 14 quid a bag, so I'm not going to waste a single block of that. And that goes back to the whole thing on Instagram, you know, that people historically think that you have to wait for your charcoal to be white and ashed over before you can cook on it. It's an absolute fallacy invented for charcoal that's got chemicals in it, because you have to burn those off before it's safe or palatable to cook on. Good lumpwood charcoal, you know, I can get it lit in 5 minutes and be cooking on it. You don't have to wait for it to be ashed over. And you can just add a lump at a time. So that's one of the ways I make my charcoal more cost effective for me, is I just start with a little bit and I just pop a lump on as I'm going along. So just sort of trying to educate people around charcoal and how to kind of make it more cost effective in order that you can buy better charcoal because you use it.
Actually, something we've never discussed before, and I'm interested to hear your thoughts on this, actually about fire lighters as well.
Yeah.
You know, I think lots of them come in the little cellophane bags that have doused in lighter fluid, or you can actually buy the bottles of lighter fluid.
Yeah.
I don't personally think they should be used. Can't be adding any, you know, nice flavors to the charcoal. Yeah. Natural, you know, the kind of wood wool type.
And that's one of the things I think people are most amazed about when they come to fire school, is that we never light a barbecue with more than one fire lighter. It's just like one fire lighter, one match, and you're good to go. And you don't need to, you know, have people come saying, oh, we stick six underneath our chimney.
Why?
It's like, why? You're, you know, you may as well set fire to a £10 note, haven't you, every time you do that? It's like, yeah, it's just, I think, I don't know. It's just a thing that, it's just people need help learning it, don't they? That, I mean, that's it. Unless you know it, you don't know it. So it's easy for people like me to say that's silly, but so hopefully by trying to educate people, it's sort of, it becomes easier.
I think as well, for like, I don't want to, the common person sounds like I'm being nasty, and I'm not at all, but a lot of people almost feel like charcoal basically grows in petrol stations, and that people kind of find it there. There's certain places that they find it and they don't even think to look and check and find out what they're using and what it could be doing to them. They spend so much time and money thinking about the meat. Why not think the same about the charcoal?
Yeah, and I see very, very, so the two main charcoal producing regions of the world are West Africa, so around the Congo, and South America, so the Amazon rainforest, basically. I see absolutely 0 point in splashing 30 quid on a sort of beautiful grass-fed, salt-aged piece of meat from, you know, some really good butcher, whatever, and then cooking it on some charcoal that's come from the Amazon that may or may not have been illegally logged. I mean, there's just an absolute disconnect there that I don't even want to get involved in. But I think people don't, my understanding of it is from all, you know, hundreds of people come through fire school, is people just don't know how bad charcoal is. It's not that they want to cook their steak on virgin rainforest trees, they just don't know that that's where it came from. You know, so it's sort of, it's all comes down to people like us being responsible and sort of hand holding people so they can make better choices, because a lot of people want to make better choices. It's not that they want to buy it, they just don't know how shit it is.
Yeah,
couldn't agree more. Great. Well, I don't think, I think that's kind of, we've gone through most of the things that we wanted to ask. I mean, is there anything else that actually, I suppose, probably should ask, what's next for you in 2022?
What's next? I've just started another book. It's a long way off though, so I'm not sure if I want to talk about it too much.
Okay, watch this space.
It's not going to be out for sort of about 20 months or something. I mean, the whole book writing process is very long. Not necessarily my bit. I've got to, I don't know, middle of next year. So, yeah, watch this.
Exciting.
Yeah.
Exciting. Oh, well, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the podcast, and really appreciate your time. And, we'll look forward to seeing your book in 20 months' time.
Yeah. Thank you. Take care.
Thanks so much for your time. Cheers.
Thanks, Genevieve. Yeah,
cheers. Bye-bye.
Bye. And that was Genevieve Taylor. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak to us. What a fantastic episode, and we've learned so much. One thing we can take from this, go outside, pick up your bag of charcoal, check where it's sourced, where it's from, and think about the choices that you're making when barbecuing. We all spend so much time thinking about the meat we're cooking, the setup and everything. Let's think about the charcoal. So, to find more out about us, Meet and Greet Barbecue Podcast, you can search for us on any search engine and you'll come across our website, our social media handles. We also have a merch store on Etsy. Go and find out. You can get some great things like mugs on there, t-shirt. It's great. Go on there. Anything you get will be supporting us, and we're going to put the money straight back into the podcast so we can get some more fantastic guests and do some more things. And we also have a Buy Us a Coffee as well on our website. It's in one of the corners. You can click on there. It's another way that you can support the show. And we'd love to hear from you as well. Again, you can message us on social media. You can drop us an email or even write to us through our website. All of our contact information is on there. And until next time, keep on grilling.
Today's episode is brought to you by AOS Kitchens, the South's leading outdoor kitchen design and installation specialists.